Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Let me start with this guy. This guy. It's gotten to the point where I can almost start a take by saying this guy. And you all know who I'm about to talk about. This guy. Because for the past few months, there has not been a more annoying, tedious, or tired topic than this guy. If it's not one thing, it is another. Instagram likes, Instagram posts, showing up at meaningless college basketball games to make sure to get his mug on TV so everybody can look at him and talk about him. By now, do you know who I'm talking about? This guy. You need more hints. Stupid Super Bowl commercials that are supposed to be funny but never are. Hanging out in a Florida park when you're not allowed to hang out in a Florida park. This guy. Coming up with a truly idiotic nickname for a city and then looking to trademark that idiotic nickname. And then walking into some random guy's house thinking it was his offense coordinator's house. You know this guy. You know the guy that I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about Tom Brady. And the fact that he walked into somebody's house thinking it was Byron Leftwich's house. Hilarious, right? Wacky as hell, right? Yeah, not really. Especially since wacky is now this dude's brand. As he has transitioned somehow from one of the coolest dudes ever to the single biggest nerd in sports. A title once held by Tiger Woods. As for the dude that he walked in on, that dude is David Kramer, the neighbor. David Kramer, the neighbor, told TMZ what happened when a legendary quarterback slash annoying would-be comedian rolled up onto him and came into his house.
This tall guy just walked in my house, just kind of like looked up at me. And he goes, am I in the wrong house? Is this Byron's house? And I was like, holy Tom Brady is in my house. By the time I could get my composure, he was like, oh, I am so sorry. Grabs his bags and just is gone.
So it turns out old Purple Nads was intending to go to Byron Leftwich's house, but instead hit the house next door. Again, that'd be a pretty interesting story if it involved a pretty interesting guy, but it didn't. It involved what is now the most boring guy ever. So not interesting at all. Not to any of us. Except Kramer there, who lost his bleep. Not interesting to any of us, but interesting, I'm sure, to a number of other NFL teams. Because the story was that Brady was there to pick up materials from Leftwich. Rather than meeting with him. You know, cool. Classic Brady. Always going the extra mile. Always looking for an edge. Always looking to do the extra work. Going to his offensive coordinator's house instead of just talking with him on the phone. Wanting to get familiar with everything. You know, like the first thing he did when he signed with Tampa Bay was ask for his receiver's numbers. What a legend. The grind, the work ethic. Yeah, except for two small problems here. Number one, he was violating the Florida stay-at-home order. Number two, he was allegedly violating NFL league rules. Also, according to PFT, players cannot meet with coaches at any time prior to the start of the offseason program. And if you're going to a guy's house, you are most definitely meeting with that guy. So let me say once again, this guy. The league looked into it and came to the following conclusion. Quote, we made an inquiry and determined that there was no violation. It was a brief personal visit and Tom picked up the playbook. End quote. All right, so no violation. Just a brief personal visit, and Tom was picking up the playbook. All right, cool. Except, why was he, quote, picking up the playbook? Isn't every playbook on an iPad or a Microsoft Surface now? Can't that be emailed or we transferred to Tom? Are we supposed to believe there's an actual book of plays on paper and that Tom was there to pick it up? And if that were the case, if it really weren't some massive three-ring binder that cannot be emailed and printed off at the home of Purple Balls, Can't you just overnight it? Can't you have a courier pick it up and deliver it? You know, because there is a stay-at-home order, and because you're not supposed to be meeting with a coach, even if it is, quote, just a brief personal visit. Yeah, and about that brief personal visit, play the clip from David Kramer one more time and listen carefully to what Kramer says in the final few seconds.
This tall guy just walked in my house, just kind of like looked up at me, and he goes, am I in the wrong house? Is this Byron's house? Then I was like, holy Tom Brady is in my house. By the time I could get my composure, he was like, oh, I am so sorry. Grabs his bags and just is gone.
Grabs his bags. Like, who brings bags?
Grabs his bags.
To a brief personal visit to pick up a playbook. Who brings multiple bags to a brief personal visit when you're just picking something up and you're going to bounce? It does not sound like a guy coming for a brief personal visit. It sounds like a dude looking to move in. When was the last time you went to visit a new coworker for a quick chat, but you showed up with multiple bags that you brought into the house? I can answer that. Never. If you show up at somebody's house with multiple bags, you're either crashing there for the weekend or you are looking to get in some serious work. You're not bringing bags into somebody's house just so you can say hello and pick up a playbook. If you're just there to drop by and pick something up, you're leaving your bags in your car. Unless you're not looking to just drop by and pick something up, you're looking to post up. If you believe this guy showed up, bags in hand, just to pick something up, you also believe that locker room attendant in New England was nicknamed the Deflator because he was just looking to lose weight. And every other excuse the Patriots have floated when they've been caught filming opponents, deflating footballs, and the like. Hey, you know what? Maybe it wasn't Bill Belichick in New England after all. Maybe everybody was wrong to gloss him Bill Belichick. Maybe Brady was the guy all along. Or maybe Brady really was just there to pick up a playbook. There could have been email to him or courier to him. Or maybe he's just the kind of dude who shows up with multiple bags everywhere he goes and then brings them into the house even on a brief personal visit. Or maybe Brady is a habitual line stepper, and he got caught stepping over the line yet again. And even if he did, it's not the end of the world. If he was violating state and league rules with that visit, I'm not saying the guy should be suspended. I'm not saying the team should be hit with some heavy fine. I'm just saying this guy's made a habit of this stuff. I'm just saying yet again, we really don't know any of these guys, and oftentimes they're not what they appear. And I'm also saying that if I were involved with another NFL team and my guys were following the rules, I'd be pretty pissed off that this guy isn't and seems to be stepping on, if not over the line, yet again. I'm saying we're talking about this guy again, and for the wrong reasons, again. And I'm sure it won't be the last time. Again, by Rick Spielman. Rick, it's great to have you back. Before we get into the draft, you and I have spoken about your amazing family in the past. So first things first, how are you and the family doing in the middle of this pandemic?
Oh, everybody's doing great. So trying to stay safe like everybody else. I do have some of my kids that are not in the medical profession, but I have a special needs daughter working at a grocery store as a bagger. I got a son that's working in the daycare center, but they are safe and everybody's doing well. Thank you for asking.
So good to hear, Rick. Good to have you back. This podcast is sponsored in part by Eno, the Capital One assistant that catches things that might look wrong with your credit card and sends an alert to your phone to help you fix them. It is another way that Capital One is watching out for your money when you're not. What's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details. CapitalOne.com. You know, so it was such an interesting draft on a number of different levels, not just because of the number of selections you had, but also because of the pandemic and the fact that it was going to be virtual. As Greg Bishop wrote in Sports Illustrated, this goes back a little bit, because last spring, the team's IT director and information systems director put together a plan that, among other things, included how the team might handle a natural disaster. So when the coronavirus hit, what steps did you take in to prepare for the draft?
Well, I thought Greg did a great job in that article kind of laying out all our preparation, but we could not have functioned in this draft without our IT department and without their foresight, not knowing the pandemic was going to hit as quickly as it did, but just them pre-planning on things, on potential disasters that could happen down the road. So from the way we functioned throughout our draft process, through our meetings, how we communicate amongst the scouts and coaches, how we're able to function on draft day and night for the 3 days was just seamless. And I can't thank them enough, and told them numerous times they were the MVP of this draft. And I also have to give credit to the league and the NFL, the football ops, their IT department, and everything that they were able to pull off to make this such a successful draft.
Frankly, Rick, I'm amazed that it came off as flawlessly as it did. They really did a great, great job. One of the steps also was moving into the JW Marriott at the Mall of America. The story goes that you were one of three guests, just three there at the time. What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I left my phone up in my room one time, and the way I got my exercise, it was 15 floors up, so I would walk the stairs to go back up to the room. And I was there for almost a month. So at night, after we met on the second floor where I was conducting my headquarters to meet with everybody, it was a boardroom on the second floor. At 10 o'clock at night, I'd go down almost one, just lock the door. It was funny. You see, I had people coming in, three different concierges that came in and kind of served us breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You know, my wife called them my au pairs. It didn't go as well when I moved back into the house. I said, "Hun, do you know that these guys did this for me and that for me?" She said, "You're more than welcome to go back there. No issues at all."
Awesome.
But they did a phenomenal job, and we moved over there during the meetings just because of the bandwidth and the technology we were using to push out the film to all the coaches and scouts and all their remote locations.
Vikings GM Rick Spielman joining us. All right, so in terms of the draft itself, with that 22nd pick, you take Justin Jefferson from LSU. Knowing the talent he has, I'm curious, what was going through your mind when he was still on the board as the pick approached, and then how good did it feel to make that pick?
Well, it's always, you know, when you have your eye on a guy and it keeps falling to you, and it seemed like that happened not only that pick, because we feel he's a great fit for the scheme that Gary Kubiak runs. He's an excellent route runner. He makes plays after the catch. And the thing that was most impressive about him was that as the games got bigger and as the bright lights came on through the playoffs and the championship game, he took his game to a whole nother level. So we're very excited that we were able to pick him there at 22. And I would say this year, and it's every year is differently, we kind of sat. We never moved up. We did move back and accumulate a lot of picks, which also turned into picks for next year. But to get an Ezra Cleveland in the second round where we got him, and some of the players we got in the fourth round where we got them. So we thought it was we had a very productive draft and really got the players that we had honed in and targeted on.
Rick Spielman joining us. All right, so to that point, you did move the 25th pick to the 49ers for picks 31, 117, and 176. Of course, Rick, one of the talking points going into the draft was whether or not trades would be reduced because everybody had to work remotely. What was that part of the draft day experience? I mean, coming in, like, what were your thoughts on that? Were there any issues in making those deals?
From a technology standpoint, there was absolutely none. And the communication amongst the teams, communication into the league as the trades were being finalized, all went flawless, just like the rest of the draft. I think it was everybody was a little bit apprehensive, especially on Thursday, where I think the year before you'd seen a lot more movement in the first round. And then I think as everybody got comfortable going throughout the draft, then you started to see a little more trade activity on Friday and Saturday.
And then, Rick, with that 31st pick, the guy you got was the guy you wanted in TCU corner, Jeff Gladney. He had played last season with a torn meniscus, but wanted to participate in the combine so badly that he delayed surgery, and he still ran a 4.48 40 on that torn meniscus. So what's that say about his speed and his toughness?
Well, those are the type of guys we tried to build this football team with. I know Coach Zimmer and I sat down, what are we building? What type of player are we building our culture with? And we can get guys that are smart guys, that are good character kids off the field, but they love to play the game. And that's just an example of this kid's competitiveness. And you've seen it during the season. I had an opportunity to go down to watch him play live against Mims, who I think is an excellent receiver when they played Baylor, and to him and step up. And every week you saw him playing against the best receiver from the on the opponent's side. So that just tells you what type of competitor he is. I also know for our scheme, Coach Zim looks for a specific physical traits to fit what the requirements of the job are going to be at the corner position. And to get him and to get Dantzler and to get Harrison Hand throughout the draft, they fit the traits that we were looking for as well.
We're talking to Rick Spielman for a couple of more moments. Rick, because you mentioned Ezra Cleveland, let me follow up on that. He was your pick in the second round, an offensive tackle from Boise State. What did you like about his tape and how he'll fit on your line?
Well, here's another example of a kid who loves to play the game. I know this year he was playing through a turf toe. So listening to our West Coast scout, Kevin McCabe out there, and he was out there, he'd wear a boot during the week and not practice, and then line up and play on Saturdays. So, but he had a lot of similarities to when we drafted Brian O'Neill in the second round a couple years ago. Very athletic kid that fits in this outside zone scheme that we run. Is a very productive blocker at the second level and out in space. Has all the physical traits and the tools we look for to fit this scheme. And it was ironic, we actually took Brian and Neil around the same spot in the draft a couple of years ago, and he's turned out to be a pretty good player for us.
So let me finally ask you this. When you consider the success you had with the draft, I mean, time will tell, but it looks great on paper. What did you learn from the draft experience that you might apply to the draft in the future? In other words, do you feel like there's certain things that you did this year because of the emergency that might actually become permanent changes?
I think the best thing about it is when you're able to get out of your comfort zone and have to come up with new ways of doing things and still trying to accomplish the same thing, it forces us to look at things and how we're going to do it differently going forward. For example, the meetings went so smooth that so instead of flying the scouts in for our December meetings and our February meetings, we're going to do those all virtually now. And so the scouts will only come in the end in the April meetings when we get together with the coaches. But I think from an organizational standpoint, as you look through how we operated from a PR standpoint, from our Vikings Entertainment standpoint, how they were able to set up all the calls, I think it was a great experience to go through. And because of the successes we had with these experiences, it's going to make us more efficient as we go down the road.
See, that makes sense to me. But if you pull this thing out of your home and you go back to the facility, not only will your family not be there to cheer on each pick, but neither will your neighbors. Are you going to miss that? I got a kick out of that.
Yeah, no, the neighbors were having a draft party out there. They drew, and I live in a little cul-de-sac, and they had 6-foot squares, and they had the campfire out there, and I'm sure they had a few beverages, and you know, they weren't going to boo me, though, because they like my wife. I don't know them because I'm never home, but they're not going to upset my wife one way, shape, or form.
I like
it. But that was the other thing that was great about this is you actually had your families involved, and they got an opportunity to see what Dad actually does, you know, on our game day, on draft day, and the preparation that goes into it. You know, I had my special needs daughter who she got 28 texts because she was on TV and thought she was famous now.
Super.
And my son was, my oldest son was sitting there knocking off the names on my board that I had on a piece of paper just in case all the electricity went out, although I did have a generator. So he participated the whole 3 days with me, and I thought that was a really cool experience for your family to be a part of this draft.
What a blast. And as I mentioned at the very top, we have talked about your amazing family in the past. It's good to get caught up there. He is the general manager of the Minnesota Vikings, 15 years in now, and the Vikes just selected 15 players in the draft. That is the most by any team since the draft changed to 7 rounds in 1994. Rick, it's great to get caught up. I appreciate the visit. Appreciate you coming back on. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on. Always a pleasure.
Jameis Winston headed back to school. No, he's not headed back to a college campus, but according to the first pick in the 2015 NFL draft, he is about to get an Ivy League education in ball because he is now officially a member of the New Orleans Saints. That's right. The massive deal and starting gig for the 2019 NFL leading passer never did come to fruition, so he is going to join a quarterback room that currently has the NFL's all-time leading passer, Drew Brees, and the NFL's all-time jack-of-all-trades, Taysom Hill. Jameis Winston is, in fact, a New Orleans Saint. So Winston, joined by another Florida State legend and former Heisman winner, Charlie Ward, told the world why he is headed to the Bayou.
Being a part of New Orleans Saints, being a part with Drew Brees, Taysom Hill, Sean Payton, Coach Joe Lombardi, Coach Pete Carmichael Jr., when you think about that room, I mean, that's like a Harvard education in quarterback school. You know, it's a proverb, humility comes before honor. So I have to humble myself. And this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be with Drew Brees and to be with the New Orleans Saints and just prepare. Just prepare for when my next opportunity is going to present itself.
And before you start with the jokes, all the jokes, and you come at me with, hey, Rome, it's not like they're not already acquainted with Jameis. He has thrown them a few touchdowns. Save that. Look, I see this guy working, and I respect it. That's a perfect response on Jameis's part. Even better if he actually believes what he's spewing. Now, I understand for a lot of you it's tough to give this guy the benefit of the doubt. I get that. But maybe the guy really does get it. Maybe the guy really is figuring it out. Maybe he really does mean what he's saying. Hey, look, no doubt this was not what he had in mind when the offseason started. But I'm going to give him some credit for understanding the reality of his situation, for understanding it, owning it, and wanting to better himself from it. Like, a lot of dudes in that situation cannot swallow their own ego. Hell, I would have been skeptical that Jameis himself could. But so far, he is saying the right things and doing the right thing. He is on the path. Question is, can he stay there? Can he stay on the path? And then the other obvious question is, can the guy stop throwing the ball to the other team? And can the guy stop putting the ball on the ground? In other words, can this guy be fixed? I mean, there's careless quarterback play, and then there's Jameis. His inability to protect the football is all world. My man is really good at almost never protecting the football. His 2019 season was secretariat at the Belmont-ish in terms of him throwing the ball to the other team. And the next closest quarterback to him in terms of INTs. Like, Jameis is looking back over his shoulder and the guy behind him is 50 lengths back in terms of turning the ball over. So that's me is the biggest question. Can this terminal turnover machine be corrected? Can it be fixed? Well, if anybody can do it, it's Sean Payton. I would say that. Then again, I would have said, if anybody can do it, it's Bruce Arians. And clearly that did not happen. Because if it did, he would still be with Bruce Arians in Tampa. Now, one of the big differences here is he's not going to get a chance to step right in and immediately start chucking it to the other team. Instead, what he gets is a different sort of opportunity. An opportunity to sit back, learn the playbook, learn how to prepare and play the position from one of the greatest to ever do it in Drew Brees. He's never had that opportunity. He's always been the guy. You know, the guy to develop his own bad habits and perpetuate them. Clearly, this is a very different situation than what he had in Tampa. Now, I'm not saying this next part to absolve him of responsibility, but in his defense, I mean, I'm not absolving him. I mean, he did turn the ball over 35 times last year. But in his defense, he was drafted by one of the worst franchises in all of sports. In his defense, he had multiple head coaches, coordinators, and didn't exactly have the greatest blockers in front of him or weapons around him. In his defense, situations do matter, and he had not been in the best of situations. But he is now. If you want coaching continuity, if you want weapons, name me a better opportunity than the one he finds himself in right now. In terms of allowing your quarterback to succeed, New Orleans has got this down pat. Now, granted, they've got an amazing quarterback in Drew Brees, but he also has good support. You got Sean Payton as the boss. The lineup on the field and the weapons they surround with Drew Brees with is just stupid. I mean, is there even a weakness on that field? Michael Thomas, Emmanuel Sanders on the outside, one of the best lines in all football up front, Alvin Kamara in your backfield. It's literally making the correct decision as a quarterback and forcing nothing. And you know who loves to force things, right? Famous. So the question is, he's in a great situation, but is he even going to get on the field? Maybe. Maybe. Even if he doesn't, I would still argue it's worth it for him to be where he is in terms of X's and O's and learning the nuances of the position and how to prepare. But then again, he might get on the field. Drew is 41 right now. He missed 5 games last year with a thumb injury. Although my man Trevor Price said, double it. Double it. But I mean, who's to say that Drew is going to play all 16 games? Saints fans certainly hope so. But if not, you might have a guy like you did last year in Teddy Bridgewater, in Jameis, who can come in and keep the ship a sail. And for Jameis, you know he's looking to run Bridgewater's playbook. You go to an amazing situation, if given the chance, you knock it out of the yard, and then you parlay that into a really nice contract the way Teddy did in Carolina. So, respect for wanting to humble and better yourself. I see you working, Jameis. Now, actually, do the work itself. And if you get an opportunity, go eat a few W's, my man.
How many of you want to eat a W tonight?
Now more than ever, we need people with the right skills to support our communities, especially the frontline workers who provide resources and care for those who are most in need. To help out, LinkedIn is offering free job posts for healthcare and essential service organizations that need to quickly fill critical roles with the people who are helping us all. If you are hiring for one of these organizations, job posts on LinkedIn can help you quickly find the right people for your frontline. LinkedIn can help you find frontline workers from its active community of over 675 million members. LinkedIn Jobs screens candidates for the skills and experience that you're looking for and puts your job post in front of qualified people who meet your requirements so you can find the right person to quickly fill critical roles. To post a healthcare or essential service job for free, or if you're in another industry and you have hiring needs, simply visit linkedin.com/Rome, linkedin.com/ROME. Terms and conditions do apply. linkedin.com/Rome. Bismack Biyombo Foundation. We are joined by Bismack himself once again. Bismack, great to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me. How are you guys?
I'm great. We're great. You know, I want to talk about what you and the foundation have been doing in terms of COVID-19 relief in just a moment, but I want to rephrase that. How are you and everybody around you doing right now in the middle of this pandemic, such an unusual time?
I'm doing great, and everybody around me doing great. You know, got my family, my three brothers here, my three sisters. We all work out Monday to Friday, and on Saturday, you know, Saturday we spend more time together, kind of like the whole day, and then Sunday, the whole room is kind of empty. Everybody in the room. Sometimes we just talk to group text message, but everybody's doing great. We kind of put up a routine that we all following every day, and obviously some of them stay still going with school, so that keeps them busy as well. And with me, just the work in my foundation with the union and kind of keeping up with all those things that have been keeping me busy. So overall, pretty good. Can't complain.
Very good. Bismack Biyombo is joining us. It sounds like you've got routine and balance, and these things are really hard to find at this time. Your foundation delivered 10,000 face masks, 780 hazmat suits to the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's an absolutely massive gift, 4 shipping containers worth roughly $1 million. How did that come to be, and what did it mean to you to be in a position to give back like that?
You know, number one, you never forget where you come from. Number two, I think because I grew up there, I see the struggle, understand the struggle, and I'm in a position to do something about it. Obviously, with our work, I've been going on for years. I think just about last year, we refurbished a few hospitals. We deliver medical containers, a medical pad, surgical room, so to speak. And this year was just under the circumstances that the whole world was facing. As far as the Congo, you know, you have a lot of people that are less fortunate, if you can say that. So now it's difficult for us to go ahead and say, hey, you know, you got to stay home, because it's a little over, we have about 80 million people, and a little over 70% of people are less fortunate. So it's difficult to really tell these people to stay at home. So that's kind of why we were trying to find ways that we could help. And obviously the number one goal was let's at least continue to refurbish and put equipment in hospitals and clinics that's in need. So in case we get hit badly, we could find a way to respond. Obviously, you got to protect people as well. That's why we kind of came up with the idea of sending a lot of facial masks out there, and as well as the asthma suits with oxygen tank attached to it for doctors, because we want to be able to protect as many doctors as we can so they can continue to treat the patients in case we get to that point. And obviously, the numbers continue to pick up a little bit. I think we were at 150 at a time, 145, and now we're reaching, I think, the 300. So hopefully soon there'll be something that will stop it. But we all kind of put in our effort together. I'm sure there's a lot of great people with great heart doing, if not the same, better than what I'm doing.
Something else. Good for you. Bismack Biyombo joining us. One more thought about that, in the sense that people who know you and know your story know that this is the way you've always been. Literally, from the time you enter the league at age 18, you've been looking to give back. Now, at that time, some people did say to you, you should probably wait until you've established yourself in the league before you start trying to give back. What was your reaction when people told you that?
You know, my reaction was always like, if I don't do it, who's going to do it? If I have to wait for the next guy, which what we always been doing, like, is there ever going to be the next guy that's going to set an example for the next generation to follow? Is there a next guy? What if we don't have a chance to build that next guy? What if this is the chance, you know? And if I don't do it for these kids, you know, for these people, who else is going to do it? So that was always my response, and obviously now looking back, I did not make a bad decision at all, because I was investing my own money, a lot of my own money at a time, and I didn't have a lot. But you know, I also was raised by great parents that I've seen them giving to other people while we didn't have much, and that gave me a lesson growing up as I'm the firstborn in my family, being able to experience that closer than the rest of my brothers, and kind of helping the rest of my brothers and sister understanding the process. So it's you know, it's really a blessing. God has really blessed all of us and put us in position where we could do more for others.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned your great parents. When you were 16, you had a conversation with your parents about being a professional basketball player. What was that conversation like, and what was their reaction to that?
You know, the conversation started at 15, to be honest, and then it took them about a year, a little over a year, for them to actually give me the green light to leave the country. I think when I was just turning 16, it was early September, they kind of agreed to, you know, have me try the water, chasing my dreams, and see how that was going to turn out. And obviously for them, you know, when you grow up in Africa is one thing, it's school, and sport is a distraction and this and that. So I promised them that if I never make it to the NBA, I'll return back home, you know, I'll go to school, I'll never talk about basketball again. So failure was not really an option for me early on, as I made this deal with my parents. Thankfully, things turn out to be what they are, and now looking back, it's not a it was not a bad decision either for myself nor my parents to allow me to chase my dreams. And obviously now they've always asked me how I continue to educate myself, so I try to read as many books as possible and learn about new things. That has been kind of my educational time as keep up with my brothers, how their school are doing, what they're learning, being able to understand from different point of view as we have different people doing different things.
Bismack Biyombo joining us. I love that part of the story that you've made it. You've hit the big time. You've realized your dreams, your potential, and your parents are still saying, yeah, that's great. Congratulations. We're proud of you. What are you doing to further your education? I love that. Now, you play for the Hornets as well as being a member of Team Jordan. Before I let you go, I'm curious, what kind of an impact has Michael Jordan had on you and your life?
My man has done a lot, to be honest. You know, he has been a great mentor throughout my career since I first got here. He's always available to help you out in whatever you need, and his lines are always open. Obviously, you ask a lot of questions, the answers, and I think, you know, as you watch this Last Dance, a lot of the things and conversation that I had in the past with him, and a lot of them is like, yeah, I remember him kind of talking about the process, but, you know, when somebody's talking about the process, you don't see it from their perspective. You just see it from everybody's perspective. But now when you get to see what he's been through, to be able to get here, because a lot of untold stories that now we get to see, and I was just so excited, and I was like, man, I think a lot of the things you always say, now seeing it makes sense, and although he's always there to give us more advice and, you know, kind of lead people in a better understanding of the game of life in general, It's been great to me. I can't really complain. Even when I left the team, it was still there. When I went to Toronto, it was still there. When I went to Orlando, it was still there helping. Even when I came back here, I think our relationship just continued to grow, which is the beauty of, you know, of having a career and being able to learn from somebody like Michael.
Bismack Biyombo, Charlotte Hornets Center. He is the VP of the NBA PA's executive board. He is the founder of the Bismack Biyombo Foundation and doing amazing work both on and off the floor. Bismack, I appreciate you very much. So good to have this conversation with you, and thank you very much for doing so.
Thank you for having me, guys. Yeah, have a good one, and everyone out there, please stay safe.
Speaking of desks, I've got a big old desk. If you're watching on CBS Sports Network, and a lot of people are staying at home and working in their home offices behind their desks. As an example, my guy, Will Reeve, he's got a desk and he sits behind it for his at-home remote hits for ABC's Good Morning America. Maybe you know Will Reeve from his TV work, or maybe you know his old man, Superman, Christopher Reeve, or maybe you had no idea who he was until he went on the air yesterday, sans pants. Without pants. Now, look, it's no secret that a lot of on-air talent are doing their very best work from home right now, Will Reeve included. So instead of going into the studio to do his live hits, he's been doing them from home and operating his own camera tripod as he adheres to responsible social distancing guidelines. Bravo. Good for him. It's the right thing to do. Problem with that is he's talent. He's a reporter. He is not a camera operator. We found that out. He's on-air talent, but he does not operate a camera for a living. And yesterday, he did not frame out the bottom half of his body for his appearance on Good Morning America. And then when they took that shot and they went to him, it showed that he did not have pants on either.
Pants on the ground, pants on the ground. Looking like a fool with your pants on the ground.
In a live shot that's now since gone viral, Will Reeve is sitting in his home office wearing a collared dress shirt, a nice-looking suit jacket, and no pants. Because I guess the pants were on the ground. That does not happen if not for COVID-19. Now, there are other anchors that will try and get away with being in studio and suiting up from the waist up. But they still wear pants. Just not suit pants. You know, maybe jeans or something. Not Will. Will had no pants on. Now, if there's no COVID-19, he's in the studio instead of sitting at home on TV with his pants on the ground. You gotta love that a guy who doesn't even have to worry about a morning commute anymore can just roll a couple of steps down the road or down the hallway to his home office, but still can't be bothered to slip on a pair of slacks. And it begs the question, how many other on-air talent are rocking their suit jacket without pants and just have not been caught yet? For the record, a jacket without pants is still a better look than a jacket with jeans. I'm talking to all of you business casual people taking your fashion cues from Seinfeld. Man, put some slacks on or nothing at all. Like my man Will Reeve. Maybe that was the play. Will Reeve without pants, though, is still not the most embarrassing moment from yesterday. That belongs to Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. On Monday, the governor took to the podium to call out everybody in his state who files for unemployment with fake names. He clearly is tired of that, frustrated, and wanted to make sure that he took dead aim at those who were doing it, and in one person in particular.
Unfortunately, it's going to take a little bit of time in these because a couple of bad apples can make this challenge that much more difficult. For instance, we had somebody apply for unemployment for Tupac Shakur here in Kentucky, and that person probably thought they were being funny. They probably did, except for the fact that because of them, we've got to go through so many other claims that one person thinking that they were funny, using somebody else's identity, is going to make tens of thousands, potentially, of other people wait. It's not okay. We can't be doing that, and we shouldn't be doing that as we move forward.
Man, you know my man, Mr. Governor, was seething. He was so pissed. He could not wait to get up there and light that guy on fire. He was so mad. I see you working, Gov. I see you working. Man, I feel you. Tupac has been dead 26 years. And because of this idiot, that probably put you another 26 weeks behind, right? No way you're going to pay him unemployment. Not somebody who's been dead for 26 years. One small problem with that, Governor. Tupac Shakur is still alive. And I'm not talking to the conspiracy theorists who believe that the rapper is still kicking it in hiding. That he's still around. That he's in Vegas or he's in LA. Or he's right down the road from me. I'm talking to the governor of Kentucky who just verbally undressed an actual Kentucky resident named Tupac Shakur, who has been out of work since March and desperately needs the check to pay his bills. Tupac Malik Shakur is a 46-year-old man who used to work at a restaurant in Lexington. He would very much like his check, Governor. Tupac, the living Tupac, said, quote, "I've struggled for the last month to try to figure out how to pay the bills. I'm hurt, I'm really embarrassed, and I'm shocked. He needs to apologize. That's just my name," end quote. How you feel now, Governor? That's just his name. That's just the way it is.
Come on, come on. That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.
You owe this guy an apology, Governor. Well, we ask and we receive. Or he asks and he receives. Because after the governor got done slamming a crow sando for lunch, he made sure to publicly apologize to Tupac Shakur.
I owe somebody an apology tonight.
Yeah, you do.
You know, last night I spent a little bit of time.
A lot of
talking
time.
Talking about fraudulent claims holding us up. I mentioned an individual that had filed in the name of Tupac Shakur. I didn't know, and it's my fault.
Now you do.
That we have a Kentuckian who goes by Malik. Whose name is Tupac Shakur. I talked to him on the phone today. I apologized. I told him how it happened, but I owned it. It's my fault. He was gracious. I said, I'm sorry if I embarrassed him or caused him any attention he didn't want. He was very kind. He ended the call. God bless. And we're going to make sure that we resolve his claim. Malik, thank you for being so kind. And again, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you something, Governor. Sorry you did it, or sorry you're in this position? Sorry you did it, or sorry you got caught? I mean, you're lucky that Tupac is a class act. He said he ended the call by being extremely gracious and saying, God bless. I'm not so sure I would have been so gracious. I would have been like, God bless, give me my freaking money, Governor. Where's my check, man? You dragged me like that. You embarrassed me like that. You couldn't wait to get in front of that camera and light me up like that. Come on, man. I want to hear that apology one more time, Alvin. One more time.
I owe somebody an apology tonight.
Yes, you do.
Last night, I spent a little bit of time talking about fraudulent claims.
A lot of time, actually.
I mentioned an individual that had filed in the name of Tupac Shakur. I didn't know.
You know why he filed in that name? It is his name.
A Kentuckian who goes by Malik, whose name is Tupac Shakur.
Right. He goes by his name, Governor.
Today, I apologized. I told him how it happened, but I owned it. It's my fault.
Malik.
He was gracious. I said, I'm sorry if I embarrassed him or caused him any attention he didn't want. He was very kind. He ended the call. God bless. And we're going to make sure that we resolve his claim. Malik, thank you for being so kind. And again, I'm sorry.
How you like that, Governor? You didn't get the jungle treatment. You got the Alvin treatment. What an absolutely insane year 2020 is. Just when you think you can't get any more bizarre, you've got a governor apologizing to Tupac Shakur for not paying out his unemployment. I've got a certain unnamed family member who's trying to check me in real time. At least he apologized. Yeah, I know. Yes, I know. He did apologize. At least he apologized. I know. He did apologize. However, I would say it could have all been avoided with a simple phone call. Hey, Tupac. Is your name really Tupac? It is? All right. Check is on its way. Check is in the mail. But they didn't bother to check because they thought they had content. They thought they had something with which to make a point. Instead, the governor swerved way out of his lane to crush a guy for his legal handle. Let's all just hope that former Miami Dolphins running back Kareem Abdul-Jabbar does not live in Kentucky, because the governor would shut his ass down and blast him from the podium for attempting to bog down the process, if not defraud the entire system. Hey, I know. I always say it. Own it. Be accountable for it. Be responsible for it. If you make a mistake, apologize for it. Mean it. Governor did all that. Governor did all that. I get it. But now you know why Tupac never wrote a track called Kentucky Love. I wish he had. I actually love Kentucky. I love Kentucky, sincerely. Jesse Bates III. Jesse, before we get into your story in the draft, I want to ask, how are you and the people around you doing right now in the middle of this crisis?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. We're doing well. You know, I'm back in Indiana with my family, so some unusual time to be spent with my family, because usually right now we'll be in OTA. So it's been a great time, great opportunity to kind of figure out what you like to do more often in your free time, because unfortunately we do have a lot of that. So and it's going along with, you know, staying in shape and working out as well. So it's a pretty unique time right now for the world.
No doubt. Jesse Bates III is joining us. You know, you mentioned your family. You recently did a beautiful video, I thought, looking back on your experience of being drafted and what that meant to you and your mother, Teresa. As you said, with the picks that were going by and your name had not been called, your mom was encouraging you. She was patting you on the back and saying, just stay patient. What do you remember about that wait to hear your name?
Yeah, I just remember just waiting, watching the first round, just in case that my name was to get called during that first day. So, no, there wasn't as much tension there on the first day. But the second day, I was expecting to go somewhere in that time. You know, my family, my mom put together a nice little draft party for me. And, you know, have probably 100 close friends and family at a bowling alley. And just sitting there, everybody's just chatting it up. And, you know, I'm trying to act as normal as possible, even though my heart's beating fast. You know, I can just feel picks after picks as people getting picked. And then next thing you know, I get a phone call. My mom stands up and she's like, everybody be quiet, everybody be quiet. And I'm on the phone and got the call. So a very special moment, not just for me, but also for my family and my loved ones who has sacrificed a lot for me to be where I am today. So
right.
Very unique moment.
Especially your mother. She made so many sacrifices, and not just your mom, but specifically your mother, who made sacrifices and worked such long hours to provide for you and your siblings. How would you describe your relationship, and what did you learn in terms of work ethic from your mom?
Yeah, my mom was a single mother. She, at one point, was working three jobs, you know, when it came to Christmas time, just to be able to have the Christmas for me and my siblings. You know, she's always been very unselfish, and her work ethic is just crazy. She showed my sister how to be a mom. My sister's a mother of two now. So it's just, you know, it's just a snowball effect as my mom creates those core principles and things that she has created to be instilled in us for us to be successful. So I give my mom a lot of props for that.
Jesse Bates joining us. I mentioned off the top that you led the team in snaps each of your first two NFL seasons. You know the old saying that availability is your best ability. How much pride do you take in the fact that your teammates can count on you to be out there every single game, if not every single snap?
Yeah, I've been blessed. I thank God for that, that I have not been injured. And hopefully I'm not for the remainder of my career. But, you know, football is a very physical sport, and, you know, usually you do get banged up. And, you know, me being able to go out there every day, I mean, every Sunday and play is very, very good for me when it comes up with contract talks and stuff like that, because availability is the best thing you can have.
Now, the team drafted Joe Burrow, of course, for the first pick overall Thursday. Not much of a surprise, but what was your reaction when it happened, and how do you think he's going to fit in with the team?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of him. I love the swagger and the mindset that the kid has. You know, he's from Ohio, so there's going to be a lot of people from Ohio that's very exciting. I think he'll bring a lot of hype, you know, media. A lot of people want to see what he can do. And hopefully, you know, in practice we can compete a little bit. I know he's a competitor. Seems like a really good guy because one of my best friends on the team is Sam Hubbard. And that is Joe's best friend as well. So it'll be fun. I'm sure we'll have a lot of smack talking. Hopefully I can pick him off a few times in practice and, you know, hopefully get each other better during practice to translate on Sundays.
Hubbard raves about him, and I know how well-respected he is in that locker room. You know, it's not just the offense, and there's a lot of heat, a lot of swagger, a lot of energy on the offense. But defensively, the team has been really active as well. What do you make of the guys who were signed, and how excited are you about how good the defense can be?
Yeah, I'm very excited with the free agency picks that we got. On the defensive side of the ball, I think that was the main focus throughout free agency. You know, as we're going through the virtual meetings and stuff like that, those guys are very active in wanting to learn the installs these past couple of days. So I'm very excited for that. I think, like I said before, I think one of the key parts of building a good team is get good guys in the locker room, guys that can come in every day at work and have that mindset of becoming a better person and a better football player. So I think it'll be really good for us this year.
You know, when you talk about becoming a better person and becoming a better player, you're talking about the culture, right? There's been a lot of talk about a cultural change, bringing in a winning mentality to Cincinnati. How would you describe that new culture, and then how important is it to maintain that?
Yeah, I think it starts from the top up, and I'm not saying from the older guys in the locker room. I think it starts from, you know, the ownership and how they carry themselves, how the coaches carry themselves, because it's all in. It's not all about what's outside that building. All the people that's in that building is working towards one thing, and that's to be successful on Sundays in this league. So I think it starts from the ownership, and then it follows down to the older guys showing the younger guys how it's done. And then I think that's how you get it rolling. So,
Jesse, one last thing. You know, guys in your position are often asked, well, what was the first thing you bought? I'm not interested in that. I'm curious about the bright red 2008 Dodge Charger that you already had when you got into the league. Tell me about that rig, and do you still have it?
Yeah, so that was my first car. I think, like I said, my mom sacrificing for me. I was in college. I didn't have a car my freshman year of college. And I was begging my mom. I would have to come home on holidays and stuff like that. I just begged her if I could have her 2008 red Dodge Charger, and she gave it up to me. I tried to tell her that I wanted to put out payments for her since I had it in college, but being the unselfish person that she is, she wouldn't let me make payments. And then after I got drafted, I paid off the car, got me a new car as well. So yeah, I still have my car as well. That's good. My baby.
Let's keep it here in SoCal. Pasadena, first stop of the day in terms of telephone calls. Martin in Pasadena. Good to have you, Martin. How are you? What's up?
Jim Rome, how are you today?
I'm great, Martin. How about you? How are things?
You feeling okay with all this stuff? You guys are living good?
We are. How about you?
You know, I'm living solo here. I don't like it. The dog smells. But anyways, I want to start with a War Mark Shapiro. I went and visited your show on Talk To back in the day, and Tyus Edney was there, and you know, of course Mark was your EP, and so Tyus Edney is there, and he had a broken wrist, and I was so psyched, so pumped up to see him. I shook his hand. He's like, dude, I got a broken wrist. But anyway,
So Martin, so if you got into the building that day, you knew Mark Shapiro? How did you know Mark Shapiro? What was the connection?
Oh, I knew him because he was best friends with my best friend's brother, and they went to Iowa.
Okay, gotcha. Good.
So they were frat brothers.
There you go.
I digress. I got three beefs, okay? The first beef is with Spring. Okay, my grass is so dang overgrown. Thankfully, I had a gardener come over and fix it the other day. Number two, and this is probably a bigger beef, why are you not on the air in L.A.? My friend had to give me a radio so I can listen to your show. I mean, you can't get on 570? I mean, come on, man. But and then thirdly, oh, I was going to talk about bad guy. I work with a bad guy. And he just brings in like three or four bags every day he comes into work. That's just how he rolls. So, yeah. Anyway.
Good night, now!